Let's continue in Exodus chapter 21. We're going to start at verse 7. These are some of the things that God and Moses were talking about immediately after the giving of the Ten Commandments. Because you remember, the people kind of panicked hearing the audible word of God, effectively telling them to knock it off with some of the things that they had been engaging in sin-wise, which were included in the overall catch-all Ten Commandments. So Moses is up on Mount Sinai. It's still Pentecost, the 50th day since they left Egypt. And God is going over some more specifics. And the way I picture it is that Moses is even maybe bringing up things that he's had asked of him by people over the last 7 weeks. Because remember, he's been spending a lot of time listening to cases. And, of course, the people are also thinking that within about 14 months, 16 months, they would be in the Promised Land. That seems to be the original timetable. They'd spend a year at Mount Sinai, and then they'd be in the Promised Land in time for fall planting. But knowing that they're not very long from being in the land, they want to know, what about this? What about that? How are we going to do this? And so God and Moses are going over some of these things. The most recent thing we're talking about is slavery. And when we say slavery, we can't allow our American experience, the slavery we had here in colonial times and then in early American history, be what comes to our heads, because that is not the same. We'll get to what that is just a little bit farther down here. But this is indebtedness slavery. It is probably the closest thing to indenture servitude that we had in early American history, where you took on a contract of work to pay back effectively a loan that allowed you to move to the United States or to pay off some debt that you had incurred in moving here to America. And so these guys have gotten themselves in trouble. They owe money, and that indebtedness contract can be moved from one person to another, the selling of the contract. That is why verse 7 has to be brought into the picture, because there is another financial contract that takes place called the dowry, the betrothal contract. And this one is not going to be zeroed out by the sabbatical year, because remember, there's a 7-year period that the Israelis are going to live under once they're in the land. 6 years of work for everybody, a 7th year of non-work, and at the beginning of that 7th year, all indebtedness contracts are zeroed out. But that's not going to be the case for any betrothal contracts that are in force. Because just like we saw in the case of Jacob with Rachel, Jacob had to build up a huge amount of money as a promise to be faithful and take care of Rachel as his wife. As I described at the time, a betrothal contract or a dowry is basically life insurance in advance to make sure that she's taken care of in the event of his early death, or it is alimony in advance. If he cheats on her or otherwise causes the need for a divorce, she has money to live off of and to take care of the kids if they have any. All right, so that's what we're talking about when we come to verse 7. The wording in our English Standard Version is not helpful, I don't think, at this point. When a man sells, and I don't like that, there is an exchange of money, but it's not like her being merchandise. When a man basically enters into a dowry contract for his daughter as a slave, and again, the word is ama in Hebrew. In a lot of places, it means a woman who is a servant, like a hired servant. But it can also mean a junior wife, a concubine. So when a man enters into this financial contract for his daughter to become an ama, and I think the proper understanding of the word here is wife. She shall not go out as the male slaves do. And that makes sense because it's not the same sort of indebtedness contract. However, verse 8 says, if she does not please her master, meaning the one who paid the money for the dowry, who has designated her for himself. That's what helps us understand the context here. He was planning on marrying her. But then he comes to the conclusion he doesn't want to marry her. But he's paid the money out. Well, it says, then he shall let her be redeemed, meaning she can go. And apparently he can get his money back. He shall not have the right to sell her to a foreign people since he has broken faith with her. So he can't treat her like a bought slave and sell her to a non-Israeli because that wasn't the deal. She was supposed to get married to him, but he has called that off. So that is why this is a different topic. Verse number 9, here's another what if. If he designates her for his son, so if he'd made the dowry contract on behalf of his son, but now he wants to call it off. The son doesn't want to marry her, or maybe dad doesn't want the son to marry her, and he wants the thing to be off. He shall deal with her as with a daughter. So he is supposed to be thinking of her as a family member, not as some sort of slave that he bought the indebtedness contract for. If he takes another wife to himself, and this is another what if he goes ahead and marries her, or his son goes ahead and marries her, but he takes another wife to himself, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, or her marital rights. Those are three items that, weirdly enough, are going to be part of the contract of marriage. Now, this is really hard on us in our modern Western thinking because we think of two people falling in love and getting married, and it's all about romance, and it's all about their feelings toward one another. Marriages have not always been like that. A lot of times marriages were alliances between families where the families were looking out what was for best for the whole family and for the man or the woman that's going to get married. And love really wasn't part of the bargain. That would be a bonus if that happened. Romance was a secondary consideration. So in these marriages, it was understood that the husband, and more to the point, the husband's family, owed her food for every day of her life, clothing for her to be dressed up in, and then the husband owed her conjugal rights. He couldn't just marry her and ignore her. He owed her, as a full wife, he would have owed her the attempt to bring on a pregnancy so that she could have children. That would be one of the responsibilities of marriage. And so here is God explaining to Moses, all right, if you've got somebody that has gone through the dowry arrangements and then they want to call it off, then these are the rules. And if they go through with the marriage and then the person goes ahead and marries another woman, and understand that God is taking consideration the sinfulness, the sinful desires of people. And even though he wants marriage to be one man, one woman together for a lifetime, God knows that people are, especially people of means, are going to marry more than one spouse. So he says, if the guy marries somebody else, then he can't scale back on what is due to her as part of the marriage contract. Then we come to the final clause in this issue. Verse 11, and if he does not do these three things for her, she shall go out for nothing without payment of money. So basically, she gets to be divorced from him or from his son, and he gets none of the dowry money back because he's the one that's in violation of the agreement. So his dowry payment is forfeit because he did not follow through with the promises. And so this section, verses 7 through 11, is important to understand. It is distinct from the section before it about indebtedness slavery. This is all about dowry agreements, dowry contracts. Verse number 12, on to a different topic. Whoever strikes a man so that he dies shall be put to death. Now you already know one of the commandments, one of the ten, was do no murder. Murder is causing the unwarranted death of another person. And we know all the way back into Genesis chapter 9, immediately after the flood, that God established the idea of capital punishment for murder. He who sheds man's blood, by man his blood will be shed. And so I'm a big supporter of legitimate use of capital punishment, because murder shows absolute and utter disregard for the image of God in another human being. And that calls for a very serious remedy. Verse 13, though, takes in consideration what we refer to as manslaughter. Verse 13, but if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, and that's the phrase that, you know, goes with this idea of God is in control of everything, right? So acts of God, by which we basically mean things that were not on purpose, things that were kind of random. So if the killer hadn't intended to kill the person, God says, then I will appoint for you a place to which he may flee. And we will see much more on this later. It'll be called the cities of refuge. And the idea is that an accidental death allows for a person to go to another court system and ask for a review of their case. And that's what God is saying ahead of time here of what he will provide. But if it was murder, verse 14, if a man willfully attacks another to kill him by cunning, you shall take him from my altar that he may die. So capital punishment for premeditated murder is the God-given punishment, remedy for such a contemptuous treatment of another human being. Verse 15, speaking of execution, whoever strikes his father or his mother shall be put to death. Now, the striking here seems to be a bigger deal than just a frustrating smacking of your mom or your dad. This is probably going to be referenced in a broader comment later, where effectively you've got a minor child, an older minor child, it seems to be, that mom and dad keep on disciplining, but they just keep disobeying. They keep getting into more and more trouble. And it almost seems as if verse 15 here is the climax of that, that mom and dad have done everything they can to make this child behave themselves. And the last straw is that the child strikes out and tries to harm, perhaps even kill, mom and dad who are trying to control them. And this is where the community has to step in. The judges have to step in. And execution is a viable response to such a horrendous disregard, not for generic human life, but for the life of those who gave life to this person. Now, I want you to keep in mind as we go through this, it is assumed that there is a judge or judges that have all of this information available to them, and they will look at individual cases and make their decisions. We'll actually see the judges mentioned from time to time in this story. So if a mom and a dad have been harmed by their child, whether a minor or someone who is of majority age, then the judge is probably going to make the determination as to exactly how severe the punishment needs to be. But it is possible that execution could be the response. Verse number 16. Now, this is the passage that I had in mind when I said that what went on in colonial America and in early Southern America is touched on by a different topic than slavery. And it's this topic right here. It says, whoever steals a man and sells him, and anyone found in possession of him shall be put to death. This is about kidnapping. And we know beyond a shadow of a doubt, historically, that colonial America had kidnapped Africans being sold as slaves. And then once they were sold here, they were treated like livestock, and they were bred like livestock, with their offspring being treated as slaves as well. But the thing that started it was kidnapping. We know that there were slave hunting parties that went out and did this stuff. According to God's Old Testament standard, and remember, God is basically has basically said in Scripture that the law is for the lawless. The law is for people who won't behave themselves. So God basically says, if you go out there and kidnap somebody else, you are worthy of execution. And if you have been involved in the merchandising of such people, you are worthy of being executed because you've shown utter and complete disregard for the image of God in those people. So, in my understanding, the slavers and the slaveholders of our early American history would have fallen under this category right here, and they would have faced very severe punishment in the eyes of God's Old Testament way of doing things. Verse number 17, whoever curses his father or his mother shall be put to death. Same sort of tie-in about striking them. This is not just saying a nasty word or two to mom and dad. This is wishing grave harm upon them and perhaps even making arrangements for it. And so no doubt we'd have to have some judges come in and evaluate just how far these people have gone against mom and dad. Verse number 18. When men quarrel, so they're fighting, they're arguing, and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist, so it gets out of control, and the man doesn't die, because if he died, then that would be either murder or manslaughter, and that would need to be evaluated by an earlier rule. But he doesn't die. He takes to his bed for a while. And then if the man rises again and walks outdoors with his staff, so basically he recovers and returns to his life, then he who struck him shall be clear. Now, understand, the only clarity that we have here is he is clear of murder charges. He is clear of charges of manslaughter because the guy didn't die. But that isn't the end of the story. It says, only he shall pay for the loss of his time and shall have him thoroughly healed. So effectively, the party who caused the harm has to pay for all the medical bills for this person and has to pay for all the days of work that he missed. That's the requirement. And I suppose if the judges wanted to, they could say that the person had to pay the boss for time lost as well as the person who lost their paychecks. Because he acted in a way that caused harm, and that needs to be remedied. Remember that a lot of this stuff is all about you should be loving your neighbor as yourself, doing unto others as you would have them do unto you. If you don't, then there need to be consequences. Verse number 20. Let's go back to the topic of indebted slaves. When a man strikes his slave, male or female, so he's got somebody that's working off a debt, and he strikes him with a rod. Now, the rod here was an implement of corporal punishment. Think of like a paddle. Think of a switch. And so in this case, apparently the one who has bought up the slavery contract or the indebtedness contract is just out of control. And so he just wails in this person until they die under his hand. It says he shall be avenged, meaning the person who was the indebted slave has to be avenged, meaning that the person who beat them to death will be charged with either murder or manslaughter, depending on their intention. However, if the slave survives a day or two and basically lives, because it's not like they survive a day or two and then die and then nothing's going to happen, because if they die, there's going to be consequences. But if the slave survives a day or two, he's basically back up and around again, he shall not be avenged. That is, charges of murder or manslaughter will not be charged against him, but neither will repayment of time lost, because the slave is his money. Now, that sounds weird to us. but this is the reality of it. The slave in this circumstance is actually paying off a debt that is owed to the boss. So if the boss causes the slave to be unable to work for a while, that's on the boss. The slave is still going to be counted those days as part of his working off of the indebtedness. Because the only way he wasn't working was because his boss got carried away in doing some sort of discipline on him. So the loss has to be borne by the boss that did the beating that he shouldn't have done. And so this is actually a reminder that slaves are people. These guys might owe money. They might have done some foolish things to cause them to owe that money, but they still are people. And they needed to be treated as those made in the image and likeness of God. And so even if you're going to use corporal punishment, which they did, to punish a disobedient servant, you don't get carried away with it because it's not appropriate. Now, we've only got about a minute left, so I'll just give the introduction to the next part. Verse 22. So men, when they strive together and they hit a pregnant woman. Now, why the pregnant woman was there, we don't know. But the point is, these two guys are fighting and they're beating up on each other, and somehow she gets hurt so that her children come out, meaning she gives birth prematurely. But there is no further harm, meaning that the baby comes out and the baby's fine, and mom suffers no harm other than having a premature birth. Then that is going to be dealt with a fine. Come back next time and we'll talk more.